Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. Politics, religion, and money. Better add sports, too. And since he's not always polite company, he'll maybe address all four. Jeff Blair and the Jeff Blair Show. Now. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Capitals Penguins series will get started tonight, 8 p.m. on CBC. As I just said before the break, that's a series I'll be watching. I've rediscovered my inner Ovi. It sounds kind of gross, but it's true. I've rediscovered my inner Ovi. Ren Lavoie of TVS Sports is on the scene. He's actually at Capitals practice right now. And he joins Stephen Brunt and myself on the Jeff Blair Show. Good morning, Ren.
Hey, hello, guys. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Are they still practicing in that shopping center?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, there's a big parking lot in, and that's where they're practicing at, on the sixth floor, I think. So it's in the suburbs, but it's a beautiful facility.
Oh, yeah. It's...
It's just a question of, you know, traveling between this morning skate, who's optional for the Capitals, and the Penguins morning skate at the main rig, who's optional too.
Before we look ahead to the Pens and the Caps, Ren, I guess we'd look back a little bit, at least to last night. Is Bruce Boudreau going to get fired?
That's a great question. I mean, the expectation at the start of the season was that at one point it will be. It didn't happen. You know, I think it was a good decision by the management at the time not to fire him because the way they played. What I didn't like about the Ducks is not the way they were playing, actually, but when you have, I think it was somewhere in February or early March, a stretch of 18-1-1, you're peaking too early. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that they were making a push to make the playoffs, but I feel like they waste tons of energy during that that period just to go back. They were trying to finish first. Which is not a bad idea either, but you're wasting a lot of time and energy. The problem that I see with Bruce Boudreau year after year, and it's funny that I'm here in Washington because I was, when I arrived at the rink, the first thought that I had was about Jose Theodore. I remember Jose a few years ago was the number one goaltender for the Capitals. He was, you know, their best goaltender by far, a 30-win-plus season. And they start the playoffs versus the Montreal Canadiens. Jose didn't play well. And at the second game, I think the first two goals he allowed, it was the end of Jose Theodore with the Washington Capitals. Mm-hmm. That was Bruce Boudreau's decision, you know, to juggle again with his goaltenders in the playoffs. And that's what I see again this year. I feel like Bruce needs to have a number one goaltender, just one goaltender. He can't have a second goaltender in his organization because he's always playing with the goaltender's head. And at the end of the day, it's not working. Never worked and never will, by the way. So that's why I don't know if they're going to fire Bruce Boudreau. He's a good coach. He'll find a job somewhere else. I'm convinced. But now they need to think about the future. There's a short window, obviously, to win the Stanley Cup. And this decision should be made, I really think, not only by the management, but they need to talk to the players.
Well, you know, I think you're right. He is a good coach, but there's a recurring theme here, right? And it does feel like he's a good coach with a fatal flaw. And, you know, again, I think he took a team this year in Anaheim that, you know, I think I had a chance to win the Stanley Cup.
Totally right.
You know, and I'm not saying he coached them out in the first round, but he didn't coach them through the first round. You can't argue with that. They're the better team in that series. They should have won that series.
they should have. I didn't pick them because of what I said before. It's not about Bruce Boudreau, really, for me. It was more about the way they played, wasting tons of energy. The way that Bruce is playing with his goaltenders, that was obvious it was coming again. And it's killing him. I don't understand why he's doing that. Now you need to know exactly what's the future for that team. I don't think they need to make major changes. Those changes were made when you look at all the players that they acquired last year. Those changes are made. Now, I think you really need to see, the players having a good meeting with the GM. And, you know, and I'm talking about, obviously, the leaders of that group. And just to have a smart discussion about what's going on. Is it still possible to win with that coaching staff? And the answer will come quickly, I'm pretty sure.
You know, Ren, 4 losses in game 7s. That suggests to me that in addition to the coach, if I'm the Anaheim Ducks, I'm taking a long, hard look at the core of my team, including Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaff.
Yeah, I understand that. But at the same time, you know what? I'm looking at those players. I mean, the way they play in major games with Team Canada, you have to that they are winners. You know what I mean? I remember Ryan Getzlaff winning the Stanley Cup. Yes, you're going to tell me it was in 07. That was a long time ago. It wasn't yesterday. But, you know, it's still possible, I think, with that group. They're getting older. It's true. But, I mean, it's not easy. The Western Conference is one of the toughest in the NHL. Obviously, there's only 2 you're going to say, but it's different hockey. Those teams are really heavy. They're not the fastest. So I don't know if I will make a change right away with Getzlaff and Perry. I will still wait and give them another chance.
Is this series coming up against Pittsburgh, is it the biggest series in Alexander Ovechkin's career?
Well, it has to be. It has to be. I mean, that's what I like about Barry Trotz. Remember what he told him when he arrived in Washington? He said, first of all, you're going to the Hall of Fame. No doubt about it. You are going to the Hall of Fame. But you want to go in the Hall of Fame just as a 50-goal scorer, or you want to go as a winner? And that's the decision you need to make. So I see big changes with Alexander Ovechkin in his demeanor, to be honest with you. I covered a little bit the Flyers series versus the Capitals, and he was a different man. Even after a win, he was not smiling at all. He was game face, telling the world that this is not because we won a playoff game or a series that, you know, it's the end of the story for us. We need to go win now the second round versus the Pittsburgh Penguins. It's going to be a challenge. And now look at the stats this morning. You know how many points Alexander Ovechkin had this year versus the Penguins in the regular season? None.
Yeah.
Zero.
And I think Sidney had 5 or something like that, didn't he?
Possible, but
yeah.
But it's crazy. So what I don't like about the Capitals, to be honest with you, yes, they have talent. Honestly, they do. But they don't have the Connor's area of this world. They don't have other players that are maybe playing on the third or fourth line. And Matt Cullen, who has already 2 goals for the Pittsburgh Penguins. I mean, Brian Ross, who has 3 points in 4 games. You look at those players, and this is the difference right now for the Pittsburgh Penguins. It's not only on Sidney, it's not only on Evgeny. Everybody can score. And this is kind of scary right now.
Yeah, that said, Washington has goaltending, you know, and in the playoffs, goaltending often is the answer, correct?
Totally right. But I'm going to say to you that on the other side, for me, Matt Murray is the real deal.
Okay.
I'm not going to compare Matt Murray, obviously, to I think one of the best goaltender this year, Braden Holtby. But that being said, if he's playing like he's supposed to, it could be really, really tough for the Capitals. Not only that, 14 of the last 20 games, and if we go back to the regular season, obviously, the Pittsburgh Penguins score four goals and more 14 times. 14 times out of 20, four goals lost. This is kind of scary. I'm telling you, it will be, I expect a great playoff series, and I expect a lot of emotions too.
So who do you think wins this series?
Maybe I'm going to surprise you, but I really think Pittsburgh's going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons. I talk about Ovechkin and his struggle versus the Penguins this year. The other thing that is a little surprising is during the regular season, they played five times versus each other. All the wins were on the visiting ice. So three wins for Pittsburgh. They were in Washington. And the two wins for the Capitals were in Pittsburgh. I don't think home ice advantage will have an impact at all in this playoff series. I think the Penguins right now are peaking, like I said before, at the right time. And they're really tough to beat. Not only, I remember talking to Chris Letang after game two versus the Rangers, and I shook my head because I didn't like the way the team was playing with Jeff Zadkoff in net. And Chris just looked at me and said, relax, we're okay. You don't have to worry. And they won right after that three big games. And the Rangers weren't able to be in those games. So it's going to be complicated for the Capitals starting tonight.
Manny, I'll tell you, you know, if you look at that Pittsburgh season in total, Ren, you know, and if they are peaking, as you say they are, and they get through this series, yeah, and then they would be certainly the favorites, I think, to represent the East in the Stanley Cup Finals. It's a team that, you know, where there were questions about whether they were a playoff team for most of the year. There were questions about whether Sid was over the hill most of the year. So, you know, if that's a team that's challenging for a Stanley Cup in June, that's a heck of a story beginning to end, isn't it?
I think so. And you know what I really like, I spent maybe the last 2 weeks with the Penguins, and what I really like is the fact that everybody's buying Mike Sullivan's plan. I mean, they're all working together. They are really tough to play in the neutral zone. I mean, good luck if you're able to go through them in the neutral zone. It's kind of crazy the way they're playing right now. They have great leadership. Evgeny Malkin is, healthy now, which is really big. And I remember reading sometime during the season that, the Penguins don't need Evgeny Malkin. And what I really like about Mike Sullivan is when Evgeny was back, just before his first game, he said, we need a player like him to make sure that we're going to go far in this playoff series. He's a big part of our group, and he's an elite player. And that message, nobody talked about what Mike Sullivan said. That message was sent to everybody who thinks that Evgeny Malkin should be traded because they don't really need him. They have unbelievable luxury of having firepower everywhere.
You know, can you imagine, Ren, what would happen here? Phil Kessel gets to raise the Stanley Cup on the ice. Can you imagine how that would go over in Toronto?
Oh my God. I understand. Totally understand.
But he's made himself useful, hasn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Which was not the case before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you, at one point, I know I talked to Jim Rutherford about that, and he denied everything about it, which is okay. But I've been told during the season by a team that they were trying to shopping him, like they were trying to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised about that. The source was great. But at the same time, I said to myself, It makes sense, but it's a little too early. And talking to a few people around the league, they say, you know what? I didn't hear that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happens. It didn't happen, obviously. That was the best decision that they made. I think Phil is playing really well. But you know what? Think about it. Phil Kessel, like the rest of the Pittsburgh Penguins, are playing really well under Mike Sullivan.
Yeah.
That's the same group. They weren't playing that way before at all. With Mike Sullivan, I think they find a guy who can have tough love from time to time, but a guy who's, smart, He's not trying to steal the show, and he was able to make sure that everybody's going to buy in his system, which is not easy with a team like the Pittsburgh Penguins, believe me, because there's a lot of egos in that room. So all those egos need to go and work together. It didn't happen in the last few years, as you know, but now I think they see that they have something special.
Ren, we're going to let you scoot. Appreciate you doing this.
No problem. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, you too. Man. It's Ren Lavoie of TVS Sports.
It's great. You just gave me a rooting interest. I need a rooting interest, right? So you can root for Ovi. That's fine. And I will root for Phil Kessel. The cup in one hand and a hot dog in the other. It'd be the greatest thing ever. The reaction here would be, it would be fantastic.
You know what I would do if I was Phil Kessel? This is really nasty. But I would arrange a Stanley Cup tour to Toronto.
Yeah, because you get the cup for a day, right?
You get the cup for a day. I would bring it to Toronto. I'd go up to my favorite hot dog vendor. I would put the Stanley Cup beside it, and I would sit munching on as many hot dogs as I wanted, holding the Stanley Cup. That is what I would do. Sorry, Derek, you were saying the morning. Really?
62% right.
So Dean Blundell and company had a poll question in this. 62% of the respondents were okay with Phil winning the cup. They read a poll. Okay.
Okay.
62%.
That sounds scientific enough for me. Yeah, sure. I don't believe it at all.
I don't believe it either.
I don't think any. No, I think there would be much grinding of teeth, but that's fine.
That may be a call topic tomorrow. How would it feel to see Phil Kessel hoisting? Well, he'd need help hoisting it. It's a little heavy. Hoisting the Stanley.
He's always tops on the fitness test. Remember that?
I forgot. I wonder if the Stanley Cup's ever been used for a big chip dip bowl before. I could see Phil doing that. Maybe putting a little Philly cream cheese in.
If he wins, he can do whatever he wants.
He can. In the cup. Eric Smith of our Raptors play-by-play crew joins us. The Raptors are in Cleveland, or they'll go to Cleveland after they work out today in Toronto. Game 6 of their Eastern Conference series is tomorrow in Indiana. Did I say Cleveland?
You did. You're skipping through ahead a couple of rounds.
See, that's how confident I am, Eric. They're going to Cleveland. It's a done deal. This puppy's over, isn't it?
You don't breathe anywhere near me so that I don't, pick up whatever view have so I can still broadcast games, if they happen to make that far to face Cleveland.
It's over.
I'm scared talking to you on the phone. I'm going to get sick.
You're not. It's over, isn't it? The series is over.
Well, listen, I think I said it to you. I know Ben's been in a lot lately, but I think it was to you a couple of weeks ago when you asked for my prediction. I said Raptors in 6. So I'm going to stick with that, and I think they close it out. That said, after the way the Raptors dominated games 2 and 3, I thought they were going to take the stranglehold in game 4 and go back to Toronto up 3-1, and they came out and laid an absolute egg in game 4 and got the doors blown off. So part of me doesn't even know what to expect going into tomorrow night's game, which we still don't even know the tip time for. But whatever time it is tomorrow night, I'm not quite sure what to expect, because you would think that it was quite the emotional high for the Raptors, obviously, and a huge emotional letdown for a Pacers team that was that close to going back home and, a chance to close out and knock the Raptors out in a big upset and everything else. But if I'm the Pacers, I also look at it and say, we had a lead for 41-plus minutes in that game. We led for the entire game 4. We've essentially controlled about 90% of the last 2 games. It's not like we've played poorly. So let's just go out, take care of business on our home floor, and force the game 7.
I'll simplify it even more, Eric. Rather than predicting the outcome of the series or predicting the outcome of the game, what are the first 12 minutes going to look like? How are the Raptors going to come out?
That's the key. And how they will and how they should, Stephen, I guess is probably 2 different questions and 2 different answers. How they should come out is with all the fire in the world, and that's what Dwayne Casey certainly wants. That's what the players were saying yesterday. I talked to, DeMar DeRozan, Bismack Biyombo, Norm Powell. They were all saying how important the opening, not even 12 minutes, the opening 5 minutes,
yeah,
just to set the tone right from the get-go. But I'll tell you, they were saying the same thing after Game 3. DeRozan even was one of the few players after Game 3 that was acknowledging, yeah, we have momentum, and we're going to take that into Game 4. And, we are the better team right now. We're going to use that in Game 4. And they didn't do it. And I think that if you're a Raptor team in that locker room, whether it be 2 hours before the game, tomorrow night or first 2 minutes, they've got to know that what they did in game four has to be wiped out immediately. They've got to go out punch first. They've got to take the crowd out of it. They can't fall down 7, 8, 9 points early on. They've got to have the ability to match wits and go punch for punch with Indy right from the opening tip in this ball game tomorrow.
Well, never mind game four. What about the first three quarters of game five? That's the one, you know, on home.
Well, and that's why I talk about it.
Yeah.
The lead for 41 plus minutes and all of game four. Indiana's essentially controlled the last two games, yet somehow, some way, they're down.
I just don't understand the being flat. I don't understand being flat in game four either. But, you know, coming back home, having, you know, apparently learned a lesson in game four, you know, and all of the emotion of that home court and understanding that that is a pivotal game in the series and the fact that they, you know, backed into that game, you know, Lord, they came out fine in the end by a hair and obviously had the great fourth quarter and played great defense in the fourth quarter. But, you know, how do you back into that kind of a basketball game given the stakes and given where you're playing?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was looking at the numbers yesterday. They had four turnovers in the first 3 minutes of the game in game five. They had four turnovers in the remaining 45 minutes. And none in the fourth quarter. So I don't know if it's nerves, I don't know if it's jitters or whatever it is, but this team has in this postseason, generally, at least, what, two or three of the ballgames, not come out well. And they've been tight. I asked Wayne Casey, actually, a couple of days ago, guys, I said, you get a, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I said, do you get a sense of what you think you can expect from your team? And he said, quite honestly, no, because there's days where it's you know, shrunken shoulders and dipped heads and, you know, sort of, faces that just have no emotion, and I think, oh my goodness, we're in for one. And they go out and kick the other team's butt. He said, there's other times where we have a crisp shoe around to practice, guys seem to be flying, everybody's smiling, everybody's feeling good, and we go out and lay an absolute egg. He said, what I really know is the first couple of minutes of the game when the guys have had a chance to go up and down the floor a few times, I know what I'm going to get from these guys. So I would imagine he wasn't too impressed with what he saw in game five and probably had every reason to be concerned about how badly the Raptors looked, how big they fell down, and thus, you know, had to pull out the miracle in the fourth quarter.
How much of that burden falls on Kyle Lowry as the guy to set the tone? You know, he's the big dog. He's the guy that's going to have the ball in his hand. How much of it actually falls to him rather than the coach?
I think it's, you know, I'll say it's twofold. I'll say Lowry and DeRozan. I think as the two-headed monster, because I think it's as much on Lowry as it is DeMar and vice versa. You know, I think at the end of the day, yes, as the point guard, he's initiating the offense. He's the aggressor on the defensive end. He's kind of setting the tone. But as good as he is, I don't think that this team can win by just going on Lowry's shoulders. I think he needs the assistance, especially for the scoring punch of a guy like DeRozan. And look what even happened in Game 5, Stephen. DeRozan finally steps up, has his best, not offensive game of the series, but offensive game of his career in the postseason. And Lowry struggled. But Lowry found other ways to impact, especially in that fourth quarter, with whether it be a defensive play, whether it be a tip-out rebound, whether it be hitting a big shot or making a big play on Paul George. He was doing other things to impact. And I think that's something that we hadn't seen from either DeMar or Kyle in other chunks of the series. You know, it's one thing if you're continuing to struggle and your shot's not falling, but find other ways to impact the series and impact the game. And I think they both did that in various ways, in different ways in Game 5.
Eric, do you think that we may see Dwayne Casey go to that really small lineup? I guess maybe the smallest lineup he can possibly go to, right? May we see him do that a little earlier because of the success they had in Game 5?
I'm not sure what to expect because that was kind of a trump card slap down that he probably wasn't anticipating using. He never played that lineup the entire season. So granted, yes, it worked, but you know that Indiana's going to have a counter to that now. That's what, you know, especially with two, almost three full days of prep, they're going to have a counter to that. So to me, I would almost keep that in my back pocket. I wouldn't say, hey, we were forced to do that in order to try and get back in this ballgame. We were forced to be creative and come up with something different. Okay, granted, it worked, but that's not going to necessarily take us completely out of our element. All that said, you still have to find a way to keep Norm Powell on the floor for certain stretches. I think he's earned his right to be on the floor and to have minutes in this rotation. And if he can give you a different look, even for just a couple of minutes here and there, you know, for 3-4 minute stretches in the second, in the third, maybe even early fourth quarter, as opposed to 1 or 2 minute stretches, I think he's a guy that can give you just that different look. Because the funny thing is, guys, not to twist your question here, Jeff, but going through into Game 5, Damari Carroll, I had the numbers, I flipped them actually to McCowan yesterday, so I'm going off the top of my head here. But in Game 3, when Damari Carroll was the primary defender on Paul George, George had, I believe, 2 field goals in Game 3. It was something like 2. one for five or something. I mean, Carroll had absolutely shut George down in games three and four. Now suddenly it's all about, well, you know, Carroll couldn't stop him in game five, and it's all about Norm Powell, and Powell's going to get those minutes. Maybe Powell should start. Let's just take a step back and realize that Damari Carroll was pretty damn good the previous two games, and it's a luxury for Dwayne Casey to have two guys that can slow down George and give him those different looks.
Eric, you've covered, I mean, you've seen all the teams in the NBA this year. Why does Frank Vogel insist? And he didn't just do it in game five. He's done it, I believe, three times in this series. Why does he insist on starting the fourth quarter with Paul George on the bench?
He shouldn't have. The only answer he has given, and I read some of the Indy papers today as well, he continues to say, I trust my guys, I trust my bench, I trust my second unit as I have all year. But it was a mistake. And I think especially when we just talked about a moment ago, having almost three full days of prep for game six on Friday, you should have played Paul George. The way he was playing the other night, you should have played him 48 minutes. Literally, you should have played every second of that ball game because there was a noticeable drop-off in the Pacers' play, and especially in their offensive play, when Paul George was on the bench. And if I were coaching, granted, I know I've never played or coached at an elite level in terms of NBA or even NCAA, but you know, I'm second-guessing what he did there as I did the other night. He should have kept Paul George on that floor for as long as it took, and I think it was a big mistake. And I'll tell you, I've tried, guys, to talk to some folks in Indiana. I'll be honest, I don't have a great relationship with any of the writers or broadcasters there outside of just a very casual, quick hello here and there, so I haven't been able to do enough digging to find out if there truly is an issue. But there seems to be something simmering below the surface with at least part of the second unit with Indiana, because the questions have continuously come up over the course of the series as to why a guy like Jordan Hill isn't playing. He was a savior for the Pacers just a couple of years ago in the postseason, arguably among their best players right alongside a Paul George or a David West or a George Hill. Now he can't even get into the rotation. And every single time Vogel's asked about Jordan Hill specifically, just says, I'm playing the guys that I think can help us win. I'm playing the guys that I think can help us win. And he's showing a lot of confidence. And Ty Lawson and Rodney Stuckey and C.J. Miles, who's even seen his minutes decrease a bit, but he doesn't seem to be playing all the weapons he has or missing the weapons he has to the point that we were just discussing. So I'm not quite sure what's happening with that locker room or with that second unit specifically.
Eric, good stuff as always. Safe travels to Indianapolis.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Take care. That's Eric Smith, our Raptors play-by-play voice on Sportsnet. And again, the Raptors will work out in Toronto today. They will go to Indianapolis tonight. Game six is tomorrow, and we still don't know the tip-off time because, there'll be network TV considerations.
Is that some conspiracy or something?
I don't think it's got anything.
Toronto conspiracy? It's got nothing to do with the TV networks in Canada.
No. And
they're mere pawns.
Yes, they are mere pawns
in this larger game. But
so
I wouldn't bet a nickel on anything in this series. Except they're this. If the Raptors come out and are dominant for the first 10 minutes of the game,
they should win.
They'll crush them.
Yeah.
They'll roll.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see, you
it's
know.
Funny, I can see this going two ways. If the Raptors win it, they're going to crush them.
Yep.
Or they're going to lose. But I don't think it's going to be a close game.
No. Well, the last game was a strange game. Yeah. It wasn't a close game.
Nope.
And on the other end, a door was opened and they were welcomed in, right? I still think, with a slightly different substitution pattern, mm-hmm. Indiana could have kind of cakewalked to the end of that game, and we would be having a very different conversation right now.
Well, again, the whole use of Paul George or non-use of Paul George in the fourth quarter is
don't give him a life.
You know, puzzling.
You're never giving a beaten opponent a life. You don't give him a chance.
Absolutely not, especially when you've got a guy like Paul George who, you know, is showing that he knows how to finish things off. There is a new professional sports team in Toronto, the Toronto Wolfpack, of Kingstone Press League One, which is a third tier of rugby league in the UK. There are teams in Wales, there are teams in England, and there's a team in France, and now there's a team in Toronto, the Toronto Wolfpack. And Eric Perez, founder and CEO of the Wolfpack, and Paul Rowley, head coach of the Wolfpack, will join us in studio when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show with Stephen Brunt. We're very pleased to be joined at this time by the founder and CEO of the Toronto Wolfpack, Eric Perez, and head coach, Paul Rowley. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So you guys had your news conference yesterday, and I mean, it was everywhere. You got great coverage for it. What does that tell you about the immediate future of this league in Toronto? Because I'm one of these people, we talked about it off air. I think given the fact you're playing at Lamport, given the fact that that whole neighborhood has changed, it could be a really great day out for people. Is that kind of how, you know, you look at maybe establishing it right away?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just speaks to the hunger for professional sports that we have in the city. Just the attention yesterday was fantastic. We were so happy with it. And I think Liberty Village and just playing in that spot, Lamport Stadium, which we now call the Den, it's got a feel that brings you back to the old Varsity Stadium, mm-hmm. you know, when a real grassroots feel, something because we want to be the people's team. Mm-hmm. So we want to sort of be accessible to all you know, people, depending on what, you know, their economic situation is. You know, we want to be able to say, this is your team. And I think Liberty Village and the Den Lamport Stadium is the perfect spot for it.
Eric, for people who don't know the story, you've got to tell the story about how you wind up with a Toronto club in a UK-based league. You know, this is rugby league. Mm-hmm. You know, talk a little bit about the league and about, you know, how this happened.
It's been a long proposition.
And it's just one of those things where you say, we're gonna get a rugby club. We're gonna establish a rugby club in a league that's based in the UK, and we're gonna play out of Toronto. People raised their eyebrows when you said that originally, including me and a lot of other people, saying that's a great idea. How the hell are you gonna do it? Well, you've done it. How did you do it?
Well, 6 years ago, I was living in the UK in Birmingham, watching Sky Sports, and Super League was on. And I was just blown away by it. And I kind of realized I'd played rugby for many years here and sort of was like, this is rugby, but, you know, this is different. And I kind of looked at it and like, this is rugby league. Mm-hmm. Did the research, realized the reasons why rugby league wasn't present, and said, you know, I've got to right this wrong and bring rugby league to Canada. And with the goal in the back of my head of, wouldn't it be fantastic to have a Toronto team playing in Super League? Because I think that it's the most Canadian sport that's never been in Canada. And, you know, started, we were lucky enough to get a show on Sportsnet World, which we're actually on the sixth season right now. We are Monday nights, featuring Super League and mm-hmm. all the stuff that we're doing for rugby league in Canada, and used that as a jumping off point and started a national team, started some clubs, and started building up huge crowds. We were getting 7,000 people at Lamport Stadium for games. And I said, okay, it's time to go over to the other side and try and make things happen, and did that, went over there, started selling the proposition to them and coming here, finding investors and just going back and forth, building it up from each side. And I'm a Toronto guy. I was born, you know, a few blocks from here. And it was my dream to bring something like this, a European sport, to Toronto, because I think promotion, relegation, things like that, we don't have that here.
Right.
And I've always been a soccer fan. I grew up watching a Soccer Saturday with Graham Leggett.
Mm-hmm.
And and I just always wanted to be a part of that. I felt more authentic to me. So I just, with a single-minded goal of just trying to make it happen and passion and a drive and not caring where my next meal came from, I went ahead and made this thing happen. So it's born out of the people.
Now, Paul, you're gonna be in charge with making this work. How are you going to, because you've got a 22 game schedule, right? 11 here, 11 in Europe.
That's right.
How are you going to make that work as a head coach? Because you're going to have guys, where will you be training? How are you going to put a team together? Have you talked to players already?
Well, the May the 1st is the deadline where we can sign players. But as you can imagine, in the UK, this has been talked about for many months, and everybody kind of knows, but nobody actually knew the detail. But mm-hmm. now, you know, finally with the launches today, it's the interest it's got in the UK is unbelievable. So, you know, I'm not a stranger to most players and people in the UK rugby league. So people are contacting me all the time, wanting a piece, wanting to know what's going on. So recruitment won't be a problem, and you know, we'll look to recruit like-minded people who want an adventure and a leap of faith and, you know, do something, get themselves outside the bubble. The world's a small place, and Toronto's a sports-mad city with so much to offer, an experience for young men. So, chuck into that a little bit of Canadian and American flavour, and then we've got some good ingredients there. And like Eric alluded to before, you know, Canadian people love sports. Throw into the mix the jeopardy and reward that rugby league's got to offer in terms of promotion and relegation. It's got some ingredients there that that I'm sure is going to take off and capture the imagination. And like I said, we'll produce some good young men. We'll give a career pathway to Torontarians and other people, you know, who see this as a career pathway. So we want to start grassroots and keep an eye and develop. And a long-term plan is to produce, you know, Canada's own grown players and, and have a team of Canadians. You know, that's a long-term plan. So we're in it for the long haul, and, you know, we're confident that we can make a real solid impact.
Paul, for people who are listening to this who might only know the Union game, probably, you know, watch the World Cup or watch Canada in the World Cup, you know, rugby league, incredibly popular in the north of England especially, that could you talk about the differences in the league game versus the Union game? Don't do the entire rule book, but just give people a sense of, because it is a different game.
Well, it's a million-dollar question. I would say the big difference is there's 13 on the field at any one time in league as opposed to 15 in Union. Immediately creating more space, you get six chances to score. So what that makes doesn't mean a lot there, but in terms of ball in play, in rugby union, I think the ball's in play about 10 minutes out of the entire 80, as opposed to rugby league where it's, you know, it'll be 30-something minutes to go in on 40 minutes. So there's more action. There's more big hits. There's more running free. There's more, you know, there's more happening, in my opinion, and I think rugby league's been the best kept secret of the world for many, many years. And this is, you know, this is finally putting, you know, that small time thing out of the corner shop and into the supermarket.
Yeah, for North America, people who are used to watching North American football with downs, it's a much more familiar game in that sense, right? But you know, a three down or a four down game, it's essentially structured that way.
But repetitive. So then you know, your fitness and fatigue comes into it, and fatigue creates space.
Yeah.
So in terms of physical attributes, you've got to have the whole package. You know, with a big heart and some unbelievable courage to get involved in it, but. All rugby's good. We want to promote all rugby. This is ours, and people have got the freedom to make a choice. And, you know, we want to encourage people to play and participate in any sort of rugby. But, you know, ultimately, we're here for the Toronto Wolfpack. We'll be performing at the Den. We'll be entertaining. We'll be making, you know, we'll be having a good time and getting amongst the community and, you know, bringing some good role models for the youngsters.
It's a tough question to ask considering you guys haven't played your first match yet. But in your mind, What is the progression for this team from third tier? And I know you don't even have players, but I mean,
listen.
But
good question.
It's
you got to have a plan,
and it's not you know, the whole idea of relegation and promotion to North American sports fans is like, I'm a soccer fan, so I get it, and I Charlton Athletic fan, so believe me, I really understand relegation these days. Yeah. But what is your vision of how fast this could go?
So, listen, I think that if we were having this conversation 25 years ago, I think this would be such a foreign concept that people wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. What do you mean you can go down? What do you mean you can go up? Imagine having a AA baseball team that 5 years later could be playing in the World Series because they earned their way there. It's a concept that we don't really, we didn't grow up with, but now because we've been exposed through the internet, through television broadcasting, showing things from around the world, I think it's something that people actually yearn for here, promotion, relegation. You're accountable. So there's consequences for losing. Losing doesn't give you a draft pick. There's no draft in this. You know what I mean? Losing means that you go down a level. Winning means that you go up. Winning means that you get the glory. So I think it's a more authentic sports experience. And I think that's something that, especially in Toronto, we could use some of that right now.
Is there a salary cap in the league? Is there, like, again, people are going to think about the economics of this because, you know, among other things, you got to fly a bunch of people back and forth across the ocean. But, you know, what are the economics of this league?
Yeah, so flying people back and forth across the ocean, for some reason, costs less or the same as flying people to Vancouver and other parts of Canada. Just, I guess that speaks to how vast our country is.
Yeah.
But there is a salary cap. It changes per level. At Super League, it's about $3.6 million for the whole team. At championship level, it's about $2 million. And at our level, it's about $1
million. Okay.
So, yeah.
And is there any kind of a broadcast deal for these games yet?
We haven't signed a deal. We have a deal over in the UK.
Yes.
Haven't signed a deal here. Are in talks with broadcasters, though, and we're pretty confident that we'll have a national deal. It's important for us to be accessible to people so that they can watch the team and watch our road to the Super League.
And I guess the next question as well would be, I don't know if there are plans in place, but if this works, could you see other Canadian cities getting involved?
Yeah, listen, so after our launch yesterday, we've already got 3,000-plus people on our season ticket waiting list.
Give us the details, by the way. How can they go about getting on the waiting list?
Yeah, torontowolfpack.com.
Okay.
And you can sign up there, and we'll have about 8,000 season tickets available, so we've already almost hit halfway there in one day, so we're really happy about that. And that's the kind of thing that the league want to see, as the plan is to expand further into Canada, Montreal being the next target, Atlantic Canada being the target after that, and then eventually into the United States as well, New York, Boston, all the eastern seaboard sides, and making this, the RFL, this league, actually a truly Northern Hemisphere transatlantic league, the first of its kind. And Toronto is, this is such a monumentous thing, actually. I'm really proud to say that we're the first transatlantic major professional sports team. And it's a huge thing. It's a point of pride and a feather in our cap as a city.
Yeah, listen, I think both Stephen and I were talking about it this morning. And actually, when the news conference, before the news conference was held, we were saying we got to get these guys on. I think it's a great. I'm really looking forward to it. As I said, I think Lamport's there's got so much potential there. You know, we've seen that with TFC, and I wish you guys all a success and. You're among friends here, so yeah, don't be strangers.
No, absolutely. Thanks for having us on, and torontowolfpack.com. Sign up for those season tickets and support the pack.
Eric Perez is founder and CEO of the Toronto Wolfpack. Paul Rowley's head coach of the Toronto Wolfpack. Again, torontowolfpack.com. Guys, thanks for doing this.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Baseball Central with Kevin Barker just around the corner. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.